Hello, it is episode 14 of series 2 of Emergency on Planet Sport. We are well into December and we are hurtling towards our season finale, which will take the form of a virtual Christmas party, which is highly exciting. The invites are out, the decorations are going up, and that will be available in mid-December. But on this episode, we're heading to Australia because a lot has been happening out there in the sport and sustainability space over the past couple of months, in particular with regards to athletes making their voices heard and sponsors really looking over their shoulders a little bit in terms of, are we actually aligned with a common purpose with the sports that we are sponsoring? Now, the issue which really drew this into sharp focus was the sponsorship deal between mining company Hancock Prospecting and Netball Australia. It was a valuable deal, but it soon became obvious that this needed to be more than just about the check. The arrangement has subsequently ended, and what happened in between is really worth exploring. So who better to get on the pod than our great friend from Series 1, former Australian netball international, Amy Steele. Hi, Amy. Great to see you. How are you doing?
Yeah, really well, thanks. And likewise, good to see you and lovely to meet you, Melissa.
Yeah, lovely to see you too.
Now, Amy, anyone who listened to your story in the first series was really struck by how the heat illness that you suffered still impacts on your everyday life. I mean, how are you at the moment? Is it still having as much of an impact?
Yeah, certainly. It's been an ever-present kind of life condition for the last 7 years. But it's actually been quite a good little season with a bit cooler nights and cooler days. So we've not kind of come into full summer yet. So hasn't been too overwhelming, touch wood.
Okay, so. Well, that's good. But I know it still takes an awful lot out of you every day. So thanks for taking the time to speak to us about this issue in your sport of netball. There's quite a lot of background and context to give here, isn't there, before we really get stuck into it. Can you just take us right back?
Yep. So take us all the way back. You know, the sport of netball has historically been consistently underfunded to the point where they're always, you know, relying on sponsorship and a lot of government support to help keep the sport alive, and also to pay players any type of money. So just to put that in context, my first season as a professional netballer, I was paid $400 and given 2 pairs of runners. And that was, you know, at the elite level, you know, at the top of the game. So
per week, per match?
No, for the year.
$400 a year?
And 2 pairs of runners. Don't forget the runners, because the runners are probably worth more than $400. But that's, you know, that's the origin of the sport. And now it's gotten to the point where players are able to access a lot more, you know, they're able to make at least enough to kind of get by off of. But in saying that, there's only a really minute percentage of the population who are making any kind of money out of netball from a playing perspective. So there's nothing to do with the players being greedy here that makes the sport, you know, unsustainable. So from a sponsorship perspective, you know, netball was always grateful to just take any money that was coming at it.
Sure.
But that's evolved over time where the brand is really built up, the brand is really developed. And there's been quite a few netballers like myself who have stepped into a bit more of an advocacy role to say, actually, we care about climate change. We care about sports intersection with other ESG issues, the environment, social issues, social justice, those kind of things, and not being scared to raise our voice on the issue. So I think netball's kind of balancing that dynamic.
In September 2022, Netball Australia agreed a 4-year sponsorship agreement, reportedly worth $15 million Australian dollars, with Hancock Prospecting. Now, they're a mining company founded by a man named Lang Hancock, currently owned by his daughter, Gina Reinhardt. In 1984, Lang Hancock was given airtime on TV to promote extreme views, such as a strategy to kill off Indigenous people by sterilising them through the water supply. To the best of most people's research and knowledge, Gina Reinhardt has never publicly either supported or distanced herself from her father's remarks. So when Hancock Prospecting became a partner of Netball Australia, the players took action.
A lot of the players actually weren't across what Lang Hancock had said, and that wasn't front of mind issue for them. However, our third ever Indigenous woman to wear the diamond dress had just got into the team for the first time. She was on the cusp of making her debut. And the dress she was first given had the name Hancock Prospecting on it. And for her, that was a immediate sort of kind of reaction to think, I don't want to be wearing this dress because that name to me and my culture means effectively advocating for cultural genocide. So she really bravely raised the issue with the Players Association saying, look, I'm not comfortable to wear this dress. I know what this name means. That issue was then taken to the Players Association. The Players Association raised it with Netball Australia and said, look, is there a way that we can get this logo removed from the player Danielle Wollum's dress so that she's able to be comfortable wearing it? Meanwhile, the rest of the playing group said, actually, do you know what? If you're not comfortable, we want you to feel comfortable. So none of us will wear it. You know, we sisters in arms is the motto of the Diamonds netball team. So it's effectively saying, you know, we stand by each other. We've got each other's back. So the rest of the playing group came together and said, Netball Australia, we want to not be wearing this logo for now until we get this issue resolved. At that point, the players were all issued dresses without the logo on it. But that was only the start of the media debacle that followed.
Yes, indeed. So what happened next?
Yeah, so I think once the players were seen without wearing that dress, the media jumped straight on it and blew up. And then there was a lot of backwards and forwards about, I was interviewed, there was other players interviewed about, why is Hancock an issue? Why are players even speaking about this? Stay in your lane, just play the sport, get on with it. There was a lot of backlash, but effectively that media rose the issue to enough of the world's attention that Hancock saw it being effective to pull their sponsorship. So they withdrew their $15 million, and then the media explodes about players speaking out about issues that they shouldn't be dipping into. But from a lot of our perspective, it was also, well, job well done. You know, we got all the players were asking in that instance was, this abhorrent statement was made. Can you as a company formally recognise that that is an abhorrent thing to say and that it doesn't reflect anyone's current opinion? You know, an apology could be issued. The fact that the company wasn't prepared to take that position really, to me, indicated that it's not a company, a brand like the Diamonds, who can influence a lot of people, especially within Indigenous communities. That's a big, you know, group of the population that we want to be able to engage in the sport. Effectively, it's just trying to align those values. What's important to you? What's important to us? Are we on the same page?
Right. Well, it's quite the story, isn't it? And there's certainly more to say on it. Melissa has been listening into our conversation. What do you make of what you've heard so far?
Yeah, there is so much to unpick there. It's such a fascinating story to hear the whole development of it, right from the underfunded nature of the sport. Two bits of real bravery stood out to me. The individual player who was facing her debut and was still ready to stand by her principles and say, actually, you know, I'm sorry, I don't feel comfortable doing this. And then the principles of her teammates, who most of you've explained, won't be having a particularly comfortable level of income, and actually say, right, sisters in arms, we stand by this and we'll stand by our teammates. So I think this is another of those ripple effects where you've identified for us a single individual who, in some ways, I mean, it's a much more difficult conversation to have, to go to your Players Association as somebody who's not, you're not a kind of established league winning netball player. You're right at the beginning of your journey at the time when you're probably most wanting just to fit in and keep your head down and prove yourself as a player, and to say, actually, there are some things that rise above that. And then to be supported by your team, that's kind of like the best of sport, isn't it? Bravery, collaboration, teamwork is such a compelling story. And then I guess the other bit that I wanted to pick up on was this really interesting attitude of the stay in your lane mantra, this idea that, oh, it's not appropriate, you should just, the level of passivity required to wear somebody's logo on your chest that's advocating for things that you totally disagree with. I just think that seems to go way beyond a requirement to stay in your lane. I mean, no one else in our society needs to wear brands day to day that they don't align with that, with their values. So I think to be saying to athletes, oh, your job is simply to play and we can plaster whatever we like across your back and chest, that just seems mad, and it seems totally within an individual's lane to be saying, this isn't for me, this, especially when it's such an extreme case as the Hancock piece. So yeah, grateful to you for sharing the story and quite bold away with what those players have done and the response to it. I think it's such a great story and insight.
Yeah, and I think you've seen, I mean, I don't know if you've seen since then, but the amount of racism and comments directed from outraged members of the public towards, specifically towards Danielle, just indicates, you know, how brave that is to step out and actually make her voice heard. And, you know, there's still people really coming for her, and she's made a name for herself, absolute positive way, by saving the game and scoring the winning goal on her debut. But at the same time, you know, she still attracted that negative attention. So bravery is a huge word for her, and I just see her as a huge hero of the sport for doing what she's doing, not just for sport today, but for the future.
Yeah. We heard on series one about the severe health impacts that you suffered as a result and still suffer from as a result of having to play in extreme heat. So I just wonder how all of this unfolding is for you of this story now. It must add quite a personal angle to it, and a real strength of feeling around, I imagine, around, come on, netball teams, that you can't be sponsored by these huge carbon emitting organisations. Do you not see the direct impact that these directions of travel are having on players' health like your own? Is that the case for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll bring it back to the point you raised before about players shouldn't have to wear names on their uniform and being told basically go work, go broke, stay in your lane, because it's really a matter of safety. And for me, it was a matter of life and death, this whole climate issue. And it's still an ongoing issue that I can't just, you know, I'm not in a privileged position to think, oh, is climate change happening in the future? You know, it's happened to me where the point where I'm still, you know, on a good day having three sleeps to get to the end of the day just to kind of stay awake, and still, you know, cannot leave the house on a day that's anything hotter than 35 degrees. It's like, am I safe to go outside? So the point that I'm trying to make is it's actually a matter of safety. So someone like Danielle does not feel safe wearing that name and communicating that message. And that is not a message that we want to reinforce at all, you know, and on any level within society. And the future of sport isn't, you know, I think we're thinking really short term if we think financial sponsorship is going to disrupt the future of sport. At the end of the day, if we don't act on climate change, sport has no future. So I'm really taking a long, I've got, I guess, enough stepping away from the sport now, have got enough hindsight to see that this is an existential threat to sport. But I suppose at an administrative level, they're still really short-term focused.
Yeah, I feel like almost this is a redetermining of the staying in your lane mantra. It's like sport's lane is highly principled, ambitious, integrity, and actually by shifting back to clean principle deals, I think that is sport aligning itself with its lane. And to do the reverse, to silence players, to accept money at all cost of principle, that feels like the veering out of the lane to me.
Now, what's interesting here is that Netball Australia have partnered for 3 years with an energy company, Origin. So, is this a conflict? Or does having an action plan with genuine targets and ambition make one fossil fuel provider more palatable as a partner than another? It's curious. It's a really delicate but fascinating subject. And I had the chance recently to speak to Origin's chief executive, Frank Calabria.
Clearly, as an energy company, it's an immense challenge for us as a sector if we want to achieve our net zero aspirations. And Origin set its ambition to actually lead the energy transition. And that means we've made some big strides in decarbonising, but we've got a long way to go in the energy sector, and we're well aware of that. Firstly, let me just talk about our sponsorship of Netball. And by the way, we're proud sponsors of Netball Australia and have been for the past 3 years, at a national team and right through to the grassroots level. Netball's a fantastic sport, high levels of support and participation. We love the fact that it reaches communities both in rural and metro areas. Just to be very clear, we will continue to support the national team and also through to the grassroots level. So We're very pleased with our relationship with Netball Australia, and that's how we think about it today. I'm okay with people voicing their views. I mean, like anyone, athletes have an entitlement to their view, and their opinion and views actually do carry some influence. So I think they need to think about the influence they carry when they express them. But in any gathering of people, whether that be large organisations, whether that be sporting organisations or clubs, there will always be an array of different opinions and views. My key thing in all of that is that you have an environment where people are listened to and respected, and as a result of that, they're heard. It doesn't shy away from the way we think about sportship partnerships. What we think about is, back to the early thing, do we actually have an alignment of values with the organisation that we are dealing with? When it comes to climate change, I think what's important is that we come together to agree the size and scope of the challenge and actually go after it together. And if we do that respectfully and align on that, that's really a good thing from my perspective, because everyone will be different on that journey and people will be learning at different points in view.
Well, I suppose, Frank, this idea of partnerships with purpose, how conscious are you of that when agreeing new deals?
I mean, it's incredibly important to us for the simple reason that, you know, we provide energy to, you know, 4.5 million customer accounts across Australia. And so therefore we touch a large part of society. You know, if I talked about Netball Australia, it's really all about local communities as much as anything else. So we really do need to make sure that our partnerships, they really do need to attach to that value, our values, but also a broader contribution than just the financial. And we recognise that's important for sports organisations, but it must be held alongside, as I say, more than the logo on the shirt. It's got to actually go, we go on the journey about pursuing something that's better for society overall. And that's the way we think about it, very seriously.
How important is it that big corporations start to take the big decisions required to tackle this topic, do you think?
Oh, I think it's critically important. And obviously we're talking about sport today, but if you thought about the industry we're in energy, we've taken big steps over the course of this year. We're accelerating the closure of our only coal-fired power station, bringing it forward 7 years, investing incredibly large amounts of money across renewables and storage. When we talk about some of the steps that people can take, firstly, we do talk about baselining those emissions and setting a target ambition. At the same time, I think it's important that leaders then set an ambition, you've set an ambition not always necessarily knowing all the plans that are going to get you there, but they at least set a clear direction as to where you want to take going forward. The steps we see across a variety of industries, Jonathan, are, you know, really people investing in renewable energy. They're looking at opportunities to switch to that. You know, the installation of charging stations for electric vehicles. So what we're going to see is, I think, a rapid adoption of electric vehicles over the next 5 years. So we're going to see those things. The review of how you travel. All of those are the steps that I think that people can take across all industries. And in particular, they're the ones that are, I think, are key for sports as they consider how they as organisations can contribute. And I think we certainly, from our perspective, working with organisations have partnerships in sport is the way we're going to help that along that journey, as we do ourselves, and we'll have to make bold calls as a large organisation. And as I've said, for energy sector, it's an immense challenge. So we're up for that challenge, and we want to help others come along on the journey with us.
So, Amy, I just wonder what you think about what Frank Calabria from Origin has had to say there. And indeed, are you and your netball friends comfortable with wearing them on their shirts?
It's a great question, and I think that's what has stirred a lot of the debate is, well, you're hypocrites, because if you can't have Hancock, then why are you wearing Origin as one of the biggest emitters? It's really, I think, the value that we're looking for isn't zero emission today. The pathway that we're looking for is we want to align as much as possible to a 1.5 degree future, and we want to work on that transition together. We all want to be a part of this transition to a zero carbon future. So I think the nuance sits in the demonstrating that clear action, to firstly to commit to zero carbon, but then to be taking demonstrable action towards it. And what Origin has said and communicated in their climate change report is, for me, quite a good amount of evidence to indicate that that's what they're real and they're, you know, genuine about. But I can also see, to the extent that they don't comply with that in the future, that this same conversation will be had about them. So it's really, they've really got to hit those targets.
So it's about keeping them on their toes and people holding them to account that these commitments are more than just a statement in a report. These are actually, as you say, demonstrable. But his point about at least being open with the conversation, engaging people, respecting all opinions, that's a good thing in your opinion, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this sport's place, I think, in this is a discussion. It's a starting the discussion, because sport enters into people's living rooms. It gets taken into a place where they can interrogate their closely held values. Because sport can penetrate into those closely held values, it's the perfect place to start these discussions and think about some of these issues. So it's not a take this opinion and digest it. It's more like a query, you know, we're just starting to talk about it. One of the most exciting moments from this whole thing for me was actually one of my best mates in Sweden sent me an article about this netball sponsorship thing in Swedish that I mean, I don't really speak Swedish, so I couldn't read it, but it was just interesting to see it because they don't play netball in Sweden. So the fact that this is getting coverage over there is just wild, and it really means it's truly become a global issue and people around the world can see, wow, those netballers stood up for what they believed in and they got the outcome they wanted with a new spot. You know, there's a new sponsor covering the same amount of money, so there's been no impact to the sport and the issue's been, you know, broadly acknowledged amongst society. So, you know, what a great outcome.
A great outcome, says Amy Steele, one that certainly resonated across the sporting landscape in Australia. Just listen to Melissa Barbieri, who's played in goal for Australia at 4 FIFA World Cups, earning more than 80 caps. She plays for Melbourne City and is noticing real change.
We feel as athletes that, you know, in the past, we hadn't had any influence on corporate partnerships and things. We just felt that we were out of the question when it came to those things. And I really want to stipulate that I feel like we're being heard a lot more these days. I feel like we can influence our club and what they do. And I certainly feel that our views are welcomed. Questions that are difficult are often hard to take for some people. But if it's an open dialogue all the time, then, you know, athletes are really feeling like they're being heard. When we get educated about what the partnership holds, what the corporate partnership is doing, you know, outside of what we see on a football pitch, then we start to realize that, you know, these things are really being thought out, and it's not just about that money, you know, that cash sound. It's about what that partnership leads to and what it means to us to actually wear the shirt. For so many of us, it's such a fleeting moment that, you know, when you look back on your time and what have you done to leave a legacy? And I think these are the things that we know, that we can put our trust in our club to know that what they're doing on and off the pitch is for the greater good. And what we're trying to achieve as a human race is just to be better, learn, grow continuously so that, you know, we're leaving the next generation with better.
That's certainly music to the ears of Emma Pocock, founder of Front Runners. Rugby legend David Pocock's her husband. We heard from them both in the first series. So high time we caught up with Emma, 2 years on from launching her brilliant organisation. Right, well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us. And it's really good to catch up. Well, a long time, almost 2 years since we had you on the first series, which was such a great introduction, really, to this whole subject. How have you found it in Australia? What have been the big milestones, the big movements, if you like, over the past 18 months or so?
Yeah, great to be with you. I suppose the really significant things that we're seeing down here in Australia is that this isn't isolated athletes speaking out anymore. This is like a real movement of athletes. We had last year the Cool Down, which was an open letter calling on the Australian government to lift our climate ambition ahead of the COP in Glasgow, and had almost 500 professional athletes from almost 40 sports sign on to that. In the wake of that, AFL Players for Climate Action launched with almost 300 AFL players wanting to do something about protecting the future of their game. And following that, we had Pat Cummins launch his Cricket for Climate Foundation with their amazing Solar Clubs initiative, which is aiming to put solar on every local club, cricket club in Australia. So, you know, this isn't something that's just one athlete here and there doing things anymore. This is sort of something that we're seeing across the entire sports ecosystem, athletes really wanting to take a lead on this and protect, you know, not just the future of sport, but the future of their community. So it's exciting times.
Exciting. Yeah, great to hear. And is there a feeling that action can follow, you know, putting a name to something? It's more than just, you know, doing that casually, that actually we can see action as a result?
Yeah, really interesting that you asked that, Jonathan, because I think one of the things that often gets missed in the media headlines, you know, when the story we hear is so often about the kind of conflict or, you know, athletes painted as hypocrites, and what often gets left out of the headlines and indeed the stories is the work that athletes are doing to create action. So you look at someone like Pat Cummins and the leadership role that he's taken publicly, but that's backed in with this real grassroots work that they're doing to try and help in the clean energy transition at cricket clubs. You look at the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association, action that they're taking. And you look, you know, at something like the Cool Down, that open letter that we had down here in Australia, modelled off the great open letter that Mel pioneered up in the UK. And it's not the only thing. There was a big movement, but we've seen a change in government and since then, and we've seen Australia sign up to some serious international climate commitments, which we didn't have before. So I think, yeah, things are changing and sport's certainly part of that.
Pioneering, Mel. Pioneering, Melissa Wilson.
What do you think? Do you think that there's particular pieces that we can put our finger on in terms of what has created that shift? Has it been those few athletes who spoke out initially, kind of leading the way and creating a footprint for more athletes to think, okay, I can do this? Or, I mean, it'll be plenty of other factors as well. I imagine the increased extreme weather that people are experiencing and the increased coverage in the news. But I guess I'm just wondering, if we're wanting this to be something that we see more and more and more, what do we need to carry on building to make sure that that's the direction of travel?
Yeah, I think it's all of those things, but also I think athletes are typically younger people. You know, you tend to retire from most sports if you're lucky in your mid-30s, and we know that climate is something that's of huge concern to millennials and to Gen Z, and they are increasingly the athletes who are competing at that level. And like we're kind of seeing across the rest of the economy, the business world, you know, people want to be aligned with employers who share their values, and a big value for millennials and Gen Z is around taking climate action seriously. And so it makes a lot of sense that athletes are wanting to use their platform to do this work. And I think, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but here in Australia, certainly seeing the impacts of climate change unfolding in our communities and even in our sport is having a really significant impact. You know, I speak to athletes all the time who have firsthand experience of it affecting their own sport, you know, training indoors because of bushfire smoke, or their fields being affected by flooding over the last couple of years with these successive La Nina events, but also for their kids. You know, that there's a whole lot of athletes that I work with who are in their late 20s and early 30s and have kids, and we've just had so much sport cancelled over the last 3 or 4 years with fires leading into floods. Yeah, there's just so much experience now of climate breakdown firsthand. It's not a kind of far off in the distance or something that happens in other countries. You know, we're really seeing that here and feeling the effects in a really profound way.
And I think that's really interesting what you were saying about the younger athletes and almost the expectations of those coming through from the current generation. Let's hear again from Melissa Barbieri, the Melbourne City goalkeeper and former Australia international. She's really interesting on this.
We've all kind of grown as athletes from going just worrying about ourselves and getting on the park and doing whatever we can to get selected, to then opening our scope and being a little bit more experienced and being more comfortable in ourselves and starting to realise that some things are actually more important to us. We want to know what's happening at the club in order to reduce waste, to not have 100 water bottles on the field. I mean, we feel so small in the relative scheme of things, But when we are being athletes, we want to have the plates in the sink. We want to reuse cutlery. We don't want to have plastic straws. We don't want plastic bottles as much as we can. So then we started to think, what can we do on a broader scope? We have sustainability offices. We have sustainability plans. And then when we come into a, you know, athlete sort of mentality, what can I do as a senior member of my squad to teach those younger kids, as Lauren Barnes taught me? What are we doing to protect the environment? As another teammate taught me, what are we doing with our extra clothing? How are we donating those things? So it's an all-compassing thing when we walk into a change room, you know, and how long do our showers run and all those sorts of things. So as athletes, we've learned that it's not only about what we can provide on the football pitch, but how we leave a legacy. And, you know, I've always wanted to leave a legacy for those on the pitch. Now I can start to feed into their environmental challenges as well.
So, Emma, how refreshing is that to hear, that at a major, you know, football club, soccer club, you've got someone of Melissa's experience recounting all these teammates who are coming through the door generation after generation with these ever increasing expectations on climate action? That's positive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so exciting. And that's mirrored across the work that we do with athletes. And I think it just goes to show the impact that education can have. You know, Gen Z that are coming through now, they've kind of been exposed to all of this stuff throughout their schooling, and it's so powerful. It kind of is a no-brainer for those athletes, not only to kind of take the action personally themselves, but to have those expectations of their clubs, of their communities. So I think that's really exciting. That's when we'll start to see really significant change, which, you know, is not a moment too soon given the urgency with which we have to get this right. Yeah.
Especially if those steps taken by players can really normalise it within a fan base as well, and be communicated in a way that doesn't come across as preachy or kind of holier than thou, but is just saying, this is our norm now. Like, we all take short showers. Quite a few of us are plant-based. We travel by public transport where we can. I think sport is definitely such a good field for normalising this and saying, no, I'm a really rational team player. Like, I live a normal life and this really matters to me, and this is the way that I can live that care out in my day to day in really what often come down to quite easy ways. So I think that will be an exciting shift.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think it dovetails so nicely with, you know, 10 years ago when my partner Dave was starting out in this kind of advocacy, it took a huge amount of courage, and I mean it still does, because you'd much rather not be talking about this stuff. You make yourself into a bit of a target. But what we're seeing is that, like, younger athletes just don't care. They just say, well, this is the right thing to do, I feel really good when I do it, and I think you should do it too. And it's so refreshing to kind of be around people who have a really strong sense of the kind of future that they'd like to build, their personal responsibility within it, and aren't really shaken by some of the kind of old school media folks who want to put them back in their place. So I think it's an exciting shift, not just in the kind of practice of these kind of sustainable behaviours, but also in the response when they get kind of negative feedback. It's really exciting to see.
Yeah. And just within a club and the team environment as well, I think that there's a power to it as well, because people mostly appreciate that the small steps aren't actually going to be the thing that they won't directly get us out of climate change. So might leave it behind. But then if the players are saying to their team managers or their kind of board level, we want you to ditch this £15 million sponsor, or we want you to upgrade all of the facilities, I think even though they're not saving the scales of emissions of these bigger organisational steps, they do lay that foundation to say, well, look, as a playing contingent, we're doing all we can, and it really matters to us that then you do likewise.
Yeah, and I think that's even further amplified when the clubs are getting the feedback that their fans also want this. You know, it makes it a lot easier if they're kind of two of their key stakeholders, their fans and the fans they're trying to acquire, and their players are saying, you know, this really matters to us and we'd like to do better as an organisation.
And just leading on from what Melissa was saying, how significant is it Pat Cummins' role and his voice in a cricket sense, because cricket is a sport which has quite a number of sort of energy suppliers as sponsors. You mentioned earlier that the main Cricket Australia sponsor is leaving that association in 2023, but we see tournaments. The recent World T20 was sponsored by the Saudis, effectively. The voice of someone like a national cricket captain can be huge. So how significant is his sort of first steps, if you like, into this space, Emma?
Well, our longest-serving Prime Minister John Howard, while he was Prime Minister, said that the Test captaincy was the most important job in the country. So, you know, Pat's got a big role just doing his job. And I think it's incredible to see the kind of leadership that he's taken on this. And a number of issues, you know. Pat does amazing work on education and child literacy and has like a really strong moral compass. So I think it has a huge impact, and it goes beyond cricket as well. I think across the kind of sporting landscape here, I know a lot of other sporting administrators were watching how that unfolded. And he just does it with so much grace, you know, has copped a lot of flack for it. But I think the thing that's really significant with someone like Pat is that they're backing up that leadership position that they're taking with a real commitment to action at the grassroots level. You know, we so often talk about wanting our sports people to be role models, but then chastise them when they are. And so I just think, yeah, hats off to him. He's done an incredible job in, you know, a tricky time where he's taking on this new leadership role within cricket and hasn't shied away from the impact that he can have. So the ripple effect that the leadership of someone like Pat can have is sort of immeasurable.
I guess it is delicate though, isn't it, for him? And you could kind of see that in some of his statements around the issue with the current sponsor who are leaving next year. Because I suppose what you don't want to say is, we don't want your money because you're an energy company. Do you think there's a balance to be struck there? Because some energy companies can prove that they are on a transition to net zero. They can invest in renewables and sustainable projects. So we don't necessarily want to ostracize them, do we, if they can bring investment into good projects? I'm just wondering where we strike that balance.
Yeah, it's one of the trickiest challenges that we face in advising athletes and sporting organisations is, where is that line? Because we do need all of these companies, whether it's, you know, people who are pulling the coal and gas out of the ground, or the people selling that energy to consumers, whether it's the banks financing those projects or the insurers, you know, providing the coverage for it. We need all of them to be on a pathway to a safe future below 2 degrees. And so how do we decide? You know, it's really complex, and I often speak to people who are kind of experts in this space who can't give a definitive answer. So yeah, I take your point there, Jonathan, and it's a really good one, and I think one of the most challenging parts of the work that we do is trying to understand the commitments that companies have made, how good they've been at meeting them, and whether those commitments are in line with a safe future. And I think, you know, a good clear line in the sand is that if they are commencing new fossil fuel projects, we know, science has told us very clearly, that that is inconsistent with a safe future. So there are a number of companies in Australia who are continuing to pursue fossil fuel expansion. And so we can kind of see now. But there are a number of big energy companies who a few years ago wouldn't have been great partners, but they have started to really accelerate their transition to a safe future. And so we're kind of in this space where some of the companies that might have been on the list that we wouldn't have been too keen on are starting to move on to into a pretty promising space. And I think that's really exciting. Exciting for the climate, but also exciting for sports sponsorship, which we know is a really challenging space at the best of times. And COVID certainly hasn't been the best of times. So
yeah, I think also maybe at the very least, what athletes taking a stand like Pat does is potentially provide a level of scrutiny that otherwise wouldn't be there. If a sponsor exists and goes totally unchallenged, then they can kind of do potentially what they like. Whereas if part of the sponsorship is that athletes are going to the papers and saying, you know, I don't feel fully comfortable about this. I'm not necessarily saying that I want all funding to be withdrawn from my sport, but I'm also saying that climate really matters to me, and it's important for me to stand by my
by those principles in some way. I think we saw that also with the British Cycling Shell sponsorship over here. I think maybe 5 years ago, maybe that could have gone unremarked. Now there's a real pressure both on the part of British Cycling and on Shell to be able to justify why they are credible sponsors to be taking on as a sports team. And I think that that level of scrutiny in itself adds a lot to the conversation, because we need that transparency to be coming increasingly in this space.
Yeah, I just think it's so interesting as well that we're in this period of so much change in the relationship between athletes and their effectively employers, because they have so much more direct access to their fans. And so, you know, athletes are starting to be able to conceive of themselves as this kind of human billboards. And so do they want to be emblazoned with companies whose values they don't share? And it is a real tension and a difficult thing, I think, for long retired athletes to kind of comprehend, because they didn't have the same direct access to their fans and a platform to build their own personal brand when they were playing and competing. And a lot of people who are in administration played at and competed at a time where that wasn't the case. So there is this kind of generational shift that's going on. I often talk to journalists about how, you know, they'll call me to find out, you know, to try and get some background on issues. And I'll say to them, like, these athletes don't want to be doing this. It takes a huge amount of courage to speak out, because everything is stacked against you. You know, you've worked so hard if you're in that position of competing professionally to get to that point, and spent so long being told what to do. It's, you know, professional sport is kind of an institutionalizing experience. And so you're often extremely vulnerable, particularly if you're playing a team sport or, you know, a sport where you are consistently told you're just lucky to be there, you know, like a lot of the Olympic sports that are really poorly funded. And so everything is really stacked against you. And, you know, there are some superstar athletes who are probably exceptions to that. And I know, you know, talking to Dave, when he was speaking about things, it was huge motivation for him to perform at his absolute best, because that made it a lot harder for them to put sanctions against him if he spoke out. But I think that often gets missed in the narrative, just how courageous these athletes who are making these choices to speak out are being, because they're running the risk of pissing off their employers, pissing off their managers, pissing off their teammates, the media, who, you know, really do come after them a lot of the time, and then potentially a whole lot of fans who disagree with them. So yeah, I think we're at this interesting moment where they do have a lot of power, but that often misses the kind of stuff, all the stuff that kind of happens behind the scenes, and the both explicit and implicit, you know, stuff that goes on to kind of try and silence them and keep them focused on just competing and playing their sport.
Well, Emma, great to catch up. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure.
Lovely to see you, Emma.
Yeah, thanks for the amazing work you're doing, shining a light on all these incredible stories.
So that's Emma Pocock from Front Runners. We also heard from former Australian netball international Amy Steele, veteran of four FIFA World Cups, in goal for Australia, Melissa Barbieri, and from the Chief Executive Officer of Origin Energy, Frank Calabria. A real variety of voices on this particular topic. And I think it's really what we're all about with this series, just trying to broaden the conversation, engage people from every sector, and normalise the conversation, bring everybody involved so that it feels natural, so that it doesn't feel like we're up here on a podium. We're actually just having a chat about something which is so vital and so important. And it actually makes me think, Melissa, about the role of the media in all of this. It is so important, isn't it? Because it's all about how this conversation is framed. You know, if you look from a newspaper point of view, are you going to turn the spotlight on someone from a hypocrite lens and say, here's a photo of you doing something that maybe is a little questionable? Or are you going to sit them down and talk in depth about their beliefs on the topic of social impact?
Yeah, or pull up sponsors and the energy companies who aren't. I feel like it's so easy to pick on individual uses of plastic bottles as the big story in the Daily Mail. Is that really the damaging thing that's being done in our society? Wouldn't it be a better story?
Or is it the mining out in Western Australia?
Yeah, I mean, much easier to pick on the one story where you don't even need to interview anyone, you can just take a photo and make criticism. Yeah, but what's going to really flag more harm?
Well, it's almost time for the Christmas party, isn't it? So pull out pull out the Christmas jumper, and we will see you in a week's time for that. Invites are in the post, and we'll see who RSVPs.
Can't wait. See you then.
Thanks, Melissa. Bye. The audio in this program from Melissa Barbieri and Frank Calabria was taken from an Origin webinar, first broadcast in October.